from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Poet and publisher Lawrence Ferlinghetti has been a pillar of San Francisco's cultural life for over 50 years.
Watching baseball, sitting in the sun, eating popcorn, reading Ezra Pound, and wishing Juan Marichal would hit a hole right through the Anglo-Saxon tradition in the first canto and demolish the barbarian invaders from Los Angeles.
The Giants fan, City Lights Books founder and mentor to members of the Beat Generation, celebrates his 100th birthday on Sunday and releases a new book. And we'll talk with some local poets, writers, and others on Lawrence Ferlinghetti's remarkable life and career. That's next. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Legendary San Francisco poet, publisher, and bookstore owner Lawrence Ferlinghetti, a central figure in the Beat Generation, celebrates his 100th birthday on March 24th. Ferlinghetti's 65-year-old City Lights Books, almost certainly the best bookstore in the United States, according to the New York Times, is hosting a series of birthday events, including a book release for his new novel, Little Boy, and the mayor's office has declared March 24th to be Lawrence Ferlinghetti Day. And in this hour, we're going to discuss the ways in which Lawrence Ferlinghetti has influenced and reflected the culture and politics of San Francisco. Joining us in studio is Chloe Veltman, reporter with KQED News, who recently had occasion to interview Ferlinghetti. Welcome, Chloe.
Hello, Michael.
Hello to you, and hello to Elaine Katzenberg. Elaine Katzenberger is publisher and executive director of City Lights Books. Good to have you back with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Oscar Villalon, managing editor of Zizova, who is also a noted San Francisco figure, and that Zizova is a noted literary journal, and he's been involved in that since, well, it's been publishing since 1985. When did you get him?
2011.
I'm glad to have you back on Forum.
Oh, thank you.
It's been too long.
Yeah.
You can actually join us in this program if you have thoughts about Lawrence Ferlinghetti, if you want to reflect on his influence on you, on his poetry, on his politics, which have been certainly formidable in terms of San Francisco's culture. We indeed welcome your involvement in the program, and you can give us a call right now and join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Let me give out that number again. Thoughts and reflections about Lawrence Ferlinghetti and his legacy, his contributions, and really his cutting a major figure here in San Francisco, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter or Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email us, forum@kqed. And let's begin with Chloe Veltman, who, as I said, had occasion recently to interview Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and he was quite spry and quite with it, for a centenarian.
He certainly is very spry, very fiery, pushed back on a lot of my questions. It was a delightful interview. We talked about all sorts of things. He shared many stories about all his adventures, and we talked about City Lights as well quite a bit.
Well, we'll talk about all that certainly over the course of this hour. Recently, I had occasion to interview Wayne Thiebaud, and I told him that he's a young man compared to Ferlinghetti. Wayne Thiebaud just hit 98, and he's still playing tennis on a regular basis.
Wow.
But let's talk about what you managed to find out in your conversations with him. He talked about San Francisco a good deal, didn't he, about maybe some of his original mission here?
Yeah, so, he got here in the very early 50s, sort of drawn to the West, seeing it as a sort of a final frontier, a place for new ideas, you know. And when he got here, he found that, I guess, there was no real literary scene to speak of.
When I arrived in San Francisco, there were downtown bookstores that closed at 5 p.m. on Fridays and weren't open on the weekends. So the whole idea of City Lights was to furnish a locus for the literary community, which we, from the very beginning, that was our aim.
And it did that. I mean, it became kind of a stop for people of literary bent to see City Lights Bookstore, just to go there and also to hope that they would, in many instances, meet Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
Right, but it was a huge risk, you know, because unlike other bookstores around the country, City Lights decided to stay open 7 days a week and late into the night. I mean, none of this 5 p.m. closing and not open at the weekends. And plus, the other thing about it was that the business was focused on selling paperback books.
So all paperback books.
Yeah, I mean, this was at a time when the literary establishment only cared about hardbacks. And Mr. Ferlinghetti said, you know, you could only get the, like, cheap sci-fi murder novel novels and murder mysteries at the paperbacks at the time. So it was a massive risk.
And there was also, talking about risks, Elaine Katzenberger, let's get into the publishing here, the risk of publishing Allen Ginsberg's Hollow. I mean, wound up in court, wound up in censorship.
Right. Well, Lawrence was really excited by Allen Ginsberg's poetry, and above and beyond any other reason, that was why he published Howl, was because he really recognized that something poetically important was happening, and he wanted to be a part of it. He was always a smart publisher, and he wanted to be part of the cultural gestalt and to make things happen. But he was aware of the fact that some of the content in Howl might be problematic for censors. And he had enlisted the ACLU before he was even arrested to put out feelers to see if they would be interested in taking on this case were that to happen. And indeed it did. And he was arrested and sent to jail and could have lost the business. And all of that was a great risk.
But it changed the whole nature of censorship, really.
Well, it was an important piece of law that was passed that opened the door for further litigation, and yeah, definitely.
And can you talk a little, you know a lot about his life and have been, you know, with him so many years and a good ally and partner and all of that. He said when he first came to San Francisco, it looked like Atlantis to him. I mean, it was a magical city to him, and it made a great deal of difference in his view, not only politically, as we've discovered, but also just his aesthetic.
Yeah, well, you know, approaching San Francisco from the bay, which is what most people had to do back then, and people forget that most GIs came through Treasure Island. Lawrence came through Treasure Island, just like other people did. And when you see San Francisco that way, as your first view of the hills, now it's, well, it's sad. It's mostly obscured from that view. But most of us who are older came to San Francisco. If you would look at the city, you'd see the hills covered in little white-looking white and pastel buildings, and that's what he describes. He describes something that sounds like a first view of Greece or something. And it was much smaller back then, obviously, height-wise and size-wise in general. But I felt that way about San Francisco when I first saw it, too, I have to say.
Yeah, likewise, too. I'll ditto that. And we'll talk more about Lawrence Ferlinghetti's life and his earlier life, particularly since he has this novel out, which is somewhat quasi-autobiographical, although he said he compared himself modestly to Joyce in Portrait of the Iris as a Young Man. It's a different version of me, or something along those lines. Oscar Villalona is with us here, too, in studio managing editor Ziziva, and that's been a literary journal since 1985, and Oscar's at the helm now. Oscar, you know, I can remember my brother had a copy of Coney Island of the Mind. It had an extraordinary effect on me as a young man. My brother, who later on would be called The Wit of San Francisco by Herb Cain, no less. But that book really transformed many people, and it had an enormous impact on so many of us.
It absolutely did. I mean, it's not unusual to hear, particularly among not just poets, but musicians, a lot of musicians, people like Tom Waits and folks like that, will tell you how much they love Coney Island of the Mind and the type of influence that had on them. I think it sold something like a million copies, something along these lines, and it's still been in print since when it first came out. I think New Directions is the publisher behind that. I think this relates to what Elaine was saying about these first impressions of San Francisco. There's a sense of freedom of the spirit in those poems. There's a sense of finding yourself, that's to say, a life beyond whatever the conventions are before you, what you've been given. And I think it's, if someone wanted to look into it more, there might be something pretty fruitful in seeing why was that this wonderful poet, writer, and artist, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, would be so apt for San Francisco at that time. You know, I was talking about this earlier with Elaine, that one of the things I think that the Lawrence represents or has represented for me, and I think for the city, and this is not just through his writing, but through the bookstore and through the book line, is this bohemianism. And by bohemianism, I don't necessarily mean the idea of, you know, we're all living rather, say, shabbily, although that could be part of it. No, rather the idea that you don't live life according to strict conventions, that, you know, you go to where the heart needs to go and that you live this sort of life of the mind. I think that's why Lawrence's writing resonates, but I also think that's why, you know, we're so happy, you know, looking forward to this weekend for the 100th birthday, because that sort of perspective, if not values, has seemed to really inform our perception of what the city is and who we are.
You might distinguish between bohemianism and beatnikism, if there is such an ism with beatnik. No, I mean, San Francisco was definitely ready for a bohemian leader, but he was also a beatnik leader, and we associate him perhaps singularly with the beat movement as much as we do Ginsberg or Kerouac or any of those figures. I read someone recently saying, I think it was Ira Silverberg, who was a fairly close friend of Ferlinghetti's, and he was saying in a journal called Celine that he's the last of the beat poets. Well, we have Diane de Prima, so he shouldn't have said it. Gary Snyder, I mean, there's still beat poets around. But what he began to stand for was a sense of really keeping that bohemian spirit alive. And it is still, I hope, alive in San Francisco, although he's been saying, and let me go back to you on this, Chloe, some things, especially when he became poet laureate, and to you, about the corporatization and really loss of that bohemian spirit?
Definitely. I mean, I think he feels that San Francisco has definitely changed in recent decades.
Little boy was quite lost. He had no idea who he was or... I mean, back in when I arrived in 1950, San Francisco was sort of the last frontier from the literary point of view, or as generally speaking. Today, it's been absorbed in the general culture of America and is no longer so special.
A lot about things like car culture, how much he dislikes what he calls autogeddon and the way that everyone's getting in their cars and, you know, following these same sorts of commercial patterns. He was very interesting when I asked him to talk about autogeddon a little bit. He became very, very passionate about that.
Autogeddon is sweeping the country and there's no stopping it. Yes, there's things that could be done, but they would be revolutionary, and the United States isn't ready for revolution.
Well, he was ready for revolution, I think.
He started one.
he started one, certainly a cultural revolution. He was also someone who was, liked to think of himself as subversive and liked to think of the poetry in the way Ezra Pound defined it as being news, or it ought to be news, even at a column, which was devoted to that at one time. But I remember in his Poet Laureate speech, he talked about that ugly tower dominating that we call Salesforce, and just even the name Salesforce and what that signified to him, what a vulgar title that is and what that says about San Francisco. I mean, this was pretty much right square on what we think of with Ferlinghetti, Oscar.
Well, yes, but, you know, I would also say this, too. I mean, things are not static, right? Things are not static. And I think one of the wonderful things about, if you will, the ethos of Lawrence and then of everyone who works at City Lights, is that it provides a portal to another way of being. So, yes, things have changed very much. And, yes, you know, we're inundated in, you know, what you could call, you know, a tsunami of capitalism. But at the same time, people still have a spirit. People still need to figure out the best way to live. Having the $2 million house and having the stocks and all that sort of stuff only gets you so far. At some point, you know, you will realize you're individual, something which Lawrence is always emphasizing, the integrity of the individual. And
he did stand for a kind of individualism that was really sui generis. We talked about it. You talked about it in terms of bohemianism.
Well, yeah, because if that's what feeds your sense of you, of your sense of a person alive at a particular time in a particular place, gives you a sense of context of history, of not being disassociated. It isn't though you're the first person ever to live. All these other things have happened. And I think one of the things about, I think, again, what Lawrence represents and what City Lights represents is that it's a possibility for being, so that, you know, I would say it doesn't look great now, but that's not to say at some point that maybe people are attracted by this very lovely and humane thing.
Well, is it safe to say, though, Alain Katzenberger, that he was, shall we say, very skeptical about San Francisco and the way it was moving really pretty early on? I mean, he said things that were quite pronouncing about San Francisco turning much too commercial and away from the spirit of innovation and away from the spirit of poetic creativity in a place that was a magnet for poets and writers and artists.
Well, I think that Lawrence has been critiquing culture internationally, nationally, locally, the whole time. And his sense of outrage over, I think Chloe used the right word, commercialism. You know, sometimes I feel like it's about capitalism particularly, and that's true too, but it's about commercialism. It's about money. It's about living your life in order to have things and being prey to the kinds of language that is used to persuade you that you need those things. And so, I mean, Lawrence is a person who is, he's also a painter, so he's a very visual person, but he's a poet.
Despite having macular degeneration, unfortunately.
Well, you know, recently, in a moment where I think he was feeling okay, he said something about, well, I can see things that other people don't see. Mm-hmm. And I thought that's quite true, and that's always been true. But I think someone who understands the power of language feels that he... This has always been his exhortation, is poets come out of your closets, come out of your academic institutions and speak to the people and talk about what's going on. And that, I think, he's always felt is his responsibility to name what he sees. You know, Lew Welch worked in advertising before he became a poet. It's not as if every person who moves to San Francisco now and makes a boatload of money is evil. Mm. People, I agree with Oscar, people have souls that need nurturing, and that's what Lawrence has created in City Lights. It's still a place where you can come and be surrounded by ideas and the people who are interested in them.
That's nicely said. I'm also struck by the fact that, and by the way, we asked Lawrence Ferlinghetti to join us here. He's been on Forum in the past, but he declined. He's not giving very many personal interviews, only to somebody with the stature of Chloe Veltman.
Well, that one was on the phone, actually.
No, but it's still an interview.
Yeah.
It qualifies.
I don't think, I think he even told the New York Times they couldn't interview him in person. So.
No, and I want to talk some more about his life with you, Alain Katzenberger, and let's talk about the fact that the last time I was with him, I was at a table at a Swords to Plowshares dinner fundraiser, a group that helps veterans, and Lawrence told me about his service, which I had known very little about. He also told me his mother was Jewish, which I never knew, but the service included being in the Navy as a young man and being part of D-Day and part of a submarine thing. I mean... He's a vet, and he really served an important role in World War II.
Yes. Oh, well, I mean, like most young men at the time, Lawrence enlisted and served in World War II, and he was one of the first Navy commanders. At that time, he likes to tell the story about how the U.S. was so unprepared at that point, which is hard to believe now considering the military budget, right? But they didn't really have enough of a Navy. And the first ship that Lawrence was in charge of was actually a yacht owned by one of the wealthy scions of industry, J.P. Morgan. And he was on a sub chaser. They were basically out there listening for submarines off the coast of the United States. But yes, he was at D-Day. He was on a ship that was far out to sea watching the proceedings. I forget what the role they had. I think they were an armada that was probably guarding what was going on. But he was there. I think the most important anecdote from all of that to tell probably, I mean, there are a number of them that are formative, but he talks about... being in transit on a warship in the Pacific and having their command changed halfway across the Pacific. And they went from being an invading force to an occupying force because the bombs had dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so they came into Nagasaki And Lawrence was, who knows what they were thinking. They gave them shore leave. Mm. And this young man is walking around in the ruins of Nagasaki 7 weeks after the bomb had dropped. And what he tells about what he saw...
made him a pacifist.
Yeah, lifelong. And yeah. It's absolutely horrific. So
appalling to him. I remember reading about that. We're talking about Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Lane Katzenberger is publisher and executive director of City Lights Books. Oscar Villalon is managing editor of Zizova. And Chloe Veltman is a reporter for KQED News who spoke with Lawrence Ferlinghetti recently. And we heard a cut that came in there by accident of Lawrence reading from his book, which is about to be on his centenary birth unveiled. In fact, I'm going to be privileged to be part of that event. It's this Sunday at City Lights, his actual birthday. This Thursday. His actual birthday is Sunday. And I don't know why I was saying to all those assembled here, I don't know why they included this failed novelist, but they've got people like Maxine Hong Kingston reading from his new book, and they've got Andrew Sean Greer, and they have, let's see, who else? Lane, can you help me here? Armistead Maupin and Joyce Carol Oates. You want to say something about this first, Chloe, before hear this cut?
We'll hear a little bit from the very, very top of this autobiographical novel called Little Boy, which I think is coming out the day after tomorrow, I think 21st.
The actual book release party is at City Lights on Thursday night. Yeah. And then we are having a big celebration for his birthday on Sunday at City Lights, too. So we can remind you about that later.
He had another novel, though, called Her. It was a surreal novel, I recall, a number of years ago. And what many people don't know, perhaps, about Lawrence Ferlinghetti is he spent a lot of time in France, which is a whole other story of his biography, and did some French translations, even. I mean, a versatile and remarkable life he has lived, and literary and otherwise. Let's hear him reading from his new novel.
Little Boy was quite lost. He had no idea who he was or where he had come from. He was with Aunt Emily, whom he loved very much. She had taken him in swaddling clothes from his mother, who already had four sons and could not handle a fifth, born a few months after his father died of a heart attack.
There are autobiographical elements there, Chloe, unmistakably.
Many, and he sort of cycles back to a lot of these sort of early memories as the novel. It's sort of written in this very stream of consciousness style, and it's interesting to me because it feels so personal and so intimate, but then it's written in the third person, and this very non-traditional, shall we say, use of punctuation, i.e. there isn't a whole lot as the book continues, and paragraphing, kind of traditional paragraphing, dissipates as well. So, it's a very compelling read, and I think you do get a lot of autobiographical detail in there, and I think this opening for me is just so my jaw drops, because in those simple few sentences, very matter of fact at the top, you get these heart-wrenching things. What a tough beginning for anyone's life,
Well, I'm looking at some sentences here. A lot of testament for Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Richard said, I read in Carrie Coney Allen of the Mine in college. Another listener writes, Ferlinghetti changed my life forever. Thank you, Larry. Love always. And we'll hear from more of our listeners. You can join us at our toll-free number. I invite you to do that. It's 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. More about Lawrence Ferlinghetti as he turns 100 on Sunday. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the life and times and heritage of Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who is identified in many singular ways with the city of San Francisco. And we've not only been talking about his life and career, extraordinary as it was, but also about often how he envisioned San Francisco and how he became identified with it in literary and cultural ways. Julia writes, my parents in the 60s were also the darlings of Herb Cain, referred to as Count and Countess Latini. My memories of the city in the 50s, 60s, and 70s were of open-minded and adventurous souls, nothing like today. What happened? And the only reason, I suppose, that there's that kind of tenor to a discussion about Lawrence Ferlinghetti is thinking again about the speech he gave when he became poet laureate of the city. And he said that San Francisco, once a divine metropolis that welcomed refugees and immigrants, has become a homogenous, wealthy enclave. And there again is that sense of wealth. Oscar, you spoke about, and Elaine spoke about, perhaps he was just talking about something much greater and more to be tended with than wealth, but he was also talking about wealth and money and too much materialism.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, these are the things that could consume your life. Again, you know, the point being something that what I think Lawrence's writing gets to, and I think what City Lights addresses, is that you need more than that. It can't be just that alone. You know, one of the distractions, and I do believe it's a distraction of wealth, is it makes you think that, you know, you're in the pinnacle of everything and that you're basically kitted out for all you're going to need for the rest of your life. And that's simply not true. You know, you have to feed the rest of you, so to speak.
I want to point out that Lawrence was nominated as Poet Laureate in 1995, I believe. That was quite a while ago that he gave that speech. So we're not talking about contemporary San Francisco even. We're talking about an era where even the first dot-com boom hadn't even happened yet. So that isn't a current critique. It's a critique of a trend. And that's a trend that's been happening for quite a long time.
A trend that he saw and he really spotted.
Absolutely. Yeah. Willie Brown was the mayor then.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
He said he voted for Willie Brown, even though he was a member then of the Green Party.
I'm surprised to hear that.
Well, again, you're welcome to join us. We're getting into politics now, too. We can't avoid it. Listener wants to know, did Ferlinghetti or any of the rest of the Beats provide any commentary on race or ethnicity in the Bay Area? It seems that they were pretty successful in maintaining a monochromatic visage. Elaine?
Oh, I don't think that's true. I think that it's always true that... men especially, and white men especially, might rise to the forefront and get the most notice and have the most access and privilege. But what you could call the Beat Generation included many more people than that. And one person I'd like to point out is Bob Kaufman. We're going to be publishing the collected poems of Bob Kaufman next year or later this year.
He was a very talented poet and a figure around North Beach unmistakably back in the day.
Yeah, it was a very integrated scene. If you look at film of that era at the clubs in North Beach where the writers and poets and quote-unquote beats were hanging out, it's much more integrated than San Francisco is today.
One of them was a man named Leroy Jones, who later became known as Amiri Baraka, but he was part of that whole scene, as many recall. Let me bring our callers in here. We're going to also talk to Jack Hirschman shortly, but let's hear from Brett first. Brett, join us.
Hey Michael. I was wondering if your guest could talk about Lawrence Ferlinghetti's connection with Italy and the Italian community in North Beach.
Lane, that sounds tailor-made for you, although he was in many ways, as I said earlier, he went to the Sorbonne and he was strongly identified with France. So.
Well, that's one half of his heritage, but Lawrence strongly identifies with his name is Ferlinghetti. And when he came to North Beach, it was still a very Italian neighborhood. And he likes to tell the stories about one of the first things he did was to carry the Italian anarchist newspapers and how the garbage guys would jump off the trucks and come in to get their various magazines and journals that they liked. He loves the fact that his landlord is an Italian landlord. He goes a long way back with that culture in North Beach and takes great pride in Italy, takes great pride in Lawrence, I have to say.
Yeah, and Oscar, let's just hear a word from you on Lawrence Ferlinghetti is really an international figure and is respected globally, not only throughout Europe, but really throughout the world.
Absolutely. I mean, that's beyond Italy, everywhere, I think, through Europe and other parts of the globe. And again, I think this just speaks to that sort of spirit of the human spirit that he captures in his writing that he's trying to get to. I think this is the thing that makes it so attractive. I don't think it's happenstance that he should have such a huge following. You know, there's something about that, about the again, the possibility of life, of seeing, you know, beauty, but also understanding, you know, the blade that's hidden underneath all these sort of things.
I haven't known him as long as Elaine has by any stretch, but I always found him a very, not only magnetic man, but a sweet man. And I think that's an important part of his character that really appeals to people. There's a kind of magnetism from that sweetness.
I think so. I think I remember when I was just the deputy book editor at the Chronicle, it was an occasion I had some sort of event to meet him. Oh, my Lord, it's Lawrence Ferlinghetti, you know, this sort of thing. And it's intimidating. I probably would have been, like 28 or something like that. And, he just couldn't be more pleasant. He was just so, modest, frankly. He just, you know, oh, yes, Oscar, I heard of you. Now, wait, probably didn't, but what a lovely thing to say, you know?
Affable.
Yeah, absolutely.
Elaine, when I came to visit you at the bookstore the other day to chat about Lawrence, you had that lovely anecdote about, you know, how he just, when he was at the store more regularly and he's just there, you know, fixing a light bulb or whatever, and people would come in and be super starstruck, but he always had lovely, you know, would engage them in conversation, right?
Yes, and I think I was telling you too that, I mean, Lawrence is actually quite shy. And I think it's one of his coping mechanisms that he, because he is a celebrity and he has to engage with people, he's gotten really, really good at that. And he's very, very open. And no amount of starstruckness actually is something that he personally feels. So it's not that he needs his ego fed that way. And I think that's why he's very approachable. But he also has this way of making you feel comfortable. If you say, I'm Michael Krasny from Saskatchewan, he'll say, oh, I was in Saskatchewan for a poetry reading once, and then the conversation will open up, you know.
There's also a very telling anecdote that I love about when he was in Paris and he saw Simone de Beauvoir along with Jean-Paul Sartre and was kind of sneaking around, didn't want to go up and, I mean, by that time, actually, he was fairly well known in his own right, but he didn't want to say, I'm Lawrence Ferlinghetti or you are who you are and let's talk or engage them in any way. He just kind of lurked. And I mean, that says a lot about his humility.
Yeah, he says, he told me he used to just sort of spy on them from a cafe across the street and wouldn't dare approach them because he was worried the waiter would boot him out the door.
Let me bring another caller aboard here, and you can join us, especially if you have memories of Lawrence Ferlinghetti or the City Lights bookstore. I want to hear a City Lights story first from Tom. Tom, go ahead.
Hi, Michael. I was in the City bookstore upstairs in the loft, and I saw these great rocking chairs there, and I said, I'm just going to sit in one of these rockers. I love rockers, but I'm trying to find Mark Twain's War Prayer and Ferlinghetti's Coney Island of the Mind. And there was a man standing there adjusting books and so on and so forth, and I was having trouble finding the books, and I said, he asked me, are you looking for a particular book? I said, yeah, I'm looking for the War Prayer. I'm looking for Coney Island of the Mind. And he pulled them both off the shelf, sat down in the rocker next to me, and we talked a little bit, and then he said, I'm Lawrence Ferlinghetti. And I almost fell off my rock. And he signed my books, and I bought a Far Rockaway of the Heart, which is a perfect celebration of his 100th birthday. What a joy.
It's a lovely story. Thank you for that, Tom. Reminds me, actually, just a footnote here of a story Jane Smiley once told me. She was seated on a plane and somebody was reading one of her novels, and she looked down at the person and she said, oh, I wrote that novel. And the person looked up, turned to the back of the book, saw her picture, said, yeah, you did. That was the end of that story. Let me get Jack Hirschman involved in this conversation. Jack, as many of you know, is also a San Francisco poet laureate and a much celebrated poet who knew and certainly has much to say about his own association and his life with Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who played a central role in many ways, Jack, didn't he?
Hello, hello.
Hello, yes, hello to you, yeah.
How you all?
Hey, Jack.
Let me just say something before, because it came up, Lawrence d'Italia. Tonight at 6:30 at the Italian Cultural Institute at 601 Van Ness in San Francisco, a show begins called Lawrence d'Italia, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Fluxus Poetry in Italy, a photo exhibition by a terrific Italian photographer. Actually, he did the cover of my poet laureate book, All That's Left. His name is Walter Pescara, and he's come over and he's going to be here tonight. And this event is curated by Mauro Aprile Zanetti, who has actually been helping Lawrence read his emails and telephone conversations, passing on to him poets from all over the world who have been sending him poems for his 100th birthday.
That's
so come on tonight at 6:30.
That's a good PR item, and I'm glad you got that to our attention.
Yeah, I was feeling badly that I hadn't mentioned that.
Yeah, you made Elaine feel better here, too. Let me ask you, though, Jack, give us a sense of you were very fond of, probably in many ways loved Lawrence Ferlinghetti. What do you want to say about him?
Well, let me say something that he said in the bit back. I heard it through the computer. Where he mentioned is this fairly what's going on. It won't be revolution.
Yeah, Jack, we're going to have to get you on a better line. Somehow that line got muffled, but we'll get back to him and hear what he has to say about Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Here's Deborah, who writes, a family friend grew up with Ferlinghetti at Big Wolf, a private lake in the Adirondacks. She claimed that his mother was the maid of a wealthy family and that she became pregnant with Larry by someone. They were almost all from Bronxville who needed to keep it secret. The family she worked for adopted him and kept his father's name a secret. Later, Larry rebelled against that incredible wealth he'd been raised with. Does this story read true to any of your guests?
Gobbled. It's a very... There are elements in there of some things that were true, but that is a completely wrong story. It's hilarious. I mean...
Somebody's writing fiction.
Yeah. No, the reality is that Lawrence... It's what you heard him read. I mean, that is straight up an autobiography, the first part of his book. And he indeed was born to a mother of four previous boys. He was the fifth, and his father was dead when he was born, and he was given away to an aunt who was at a certain point a nanny for a very wealthy family. She may have had a dalliance with the wealthy husband. That's not clear, but she disappeared and left him there. And he was orphaned and left behind at this wealthy family who kept him for a while and made sure that he was schooled.
Don't ask me how I remember things like that. Their name was Bislund.
Bislund.
Yeah. But there was almost a sense of his feeling like an orphan, which is really melded into this new novel of his.
I mean, basically he was.
And we got Jack Hirschman back. Jack, hope we have a good line here.
Yeah, let's hope so.
Well, tell us your thoughts about Lawrence Ferlinghetti as he comes up on 100.
Yes. Let me say this. Lawrence does not consider himself a beatnik.
Oh, thank you. Yes.
He published the beat poets. Alan and Jack, they were connected with the beat movement, or they created it in part, but he published it. There's reasons why. I think it goes back to his getting his doctoral in Paris at the Sorbonne. But also, he at the same time, Elaine was quite right, he was a complete internationalist. France was his first language, in fact. And indeed, throughout his life, he devoted himself to a certain sense of international poetry. Mm. Now, the poet, what he says in Despair about revolution, as you heard a bit earlier, it's not exactly true, because I don't know who said it, but I think it was Henry Miller who said, poets are the leaders of the world. Today, more than ever, but in this generation, from the Bronx, where I come from, Lawrence comes from the Yonkers, grew a revolution in hip-hop that's migrated all over the world. There are more poets in the world than ever before, and why not? Because everyone lives poetically within themselves. So the whole world is a world full of poets if they only understand the language and get a piece of paper and start writing.
I like, I'm sorry, Jack, but I like Percy Shelley's line. You know, they're the unacknowledged legislators.
Oh, that's a good one, too. That belonged in the 19th century, though.
Yeah, it doesn't have anything to do with rap. That's right.
No, indeed. Because it's our job in this world, and I'm also a member of the World Poetry Movement centered in Medellin, Colombia, and we put on events. We have planetary chats. We have now a planetariat rather than the proletariat of the particular first part of the 20th century. With our computers now, we belong, all of us, to the planetariat. And it's about time we got started organizing the real revolution of the future, which will be the greatest communist revolution in the history of the world.
We'll leave it there. Jack Hirschman, always good to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Ciao.
Jack Hirschman, San Francisco poet, translator, editor, social activist, and former poet laureate. And how much did that title mean to him, Elaine Katzenberger? It came late for him, as you indicated.
He's had, yes, that's true. But he was the first poet laureate, so it's not as if they were waiting for him. And actually, it's interesting because there have been a few honors that he's received that he has been the first recipient. So it's like they think of him on some level.
What's the one he got from the French? That was that's a major literary award, right?
Right, but that wasn't original for Ferlinghetti.
It was original for an American who was known as a founder of the Beat Movement, or at least a supporter. Let's not go where Jack told us not to go here.
Haven't they already taken us off the air? I mean, I do want to. I wanted to say that what Jack said about Lawrence being a beat or not is important, because I think I'm going to see him tomorrow, and he'll scold me if I don't also stand up about that. But and the part about Lawrence being an internationalist, I think that is really important, and that is part of City Lights' mission. And I do think that's part of why Lawrence is so beloved around the world, because he actually was an internationalist, and he traveled to other countries, and he published people from other countries, and he was aware of what was going on in these other places, you know, in the poetry world, in the literary world, and in the political world. And he's always been a very political person. And so there have been times when, you know, for example, the Hungarian Pen wanted to give him an award a few years back, and things weren't so right in Hungary and still aren't. And Lawrence didn't want to accept that prize, but he didn't want to offend Penn or lessen the work of Penn, and through investigations found out that that organization was being used as a front for the government, and he should turn it down. And so, I mean, I think there's lots of times when, you know, awards have been offered and he's also not accepted them. One time he was invited by the Pope to be part of some small gathering that I guess the Pope has each year, and where maybe they give people medals. I'm not quite sure, but I remember...
Was this Francis or before Francis?
No, it was a couple of popes ago, but sorry to say it that way. So, yeah, but, I mean, Lawrence would say it that way, too. And Lawrence actually wrote his letter back declining the invitations, you know, began with, "Dear Pope." So
he did decline that one, huh?
Yeah.
Well, here's Bobby who writes, "My dad was Lawrence's stockbroker in the early 50s. If I remember my dad's recollection correctly, Lawrence came in to sell stock so he could open a bookstore. My father told him that he didn't think it was a good idea. Fortunately, he didn't take my dad's advice." And here's Elizabeth, who writes, "I first came to City Lights Books in 1967, visiting San Francisco when I was 17 years old. Now I live in the Bay Area and frequently visit City Lights to restore my soul and buy books, of course. Outside the bookstore are the words, 'Open heart, open doors, open mind.' Even as a 69-year-old woman, I always feel a youthful sense of adventure and optimism about the world while browsing the bookstore." More of your calls. Chris joins us. Chris, you're on.
Hey, Michael. Yeah, Chris in San Francisco. And, you know, I'm a former English major, recovering English major. And for years, I've known that we've really need to honor Lawrence Ferlinghetti. He's an amazing local icon, international icon. And 2 years ago, we started creating a Ferlinghetti Day on his birthday. So if Dublin can honor Joyce on Bloomsday each June 16th, I just felt like no one else is doing this. Let's make this happen. 7:06 a.m. across from 706 Wisconsin Street, Potrero Hill. We're actually going to, a bunch of us literary pilgrims are going to walk on over to North Beach and in time for all the festivities.
That's great. Great to
Sunday
hear.
Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, and enjoy those festivities, and thank you for calling us. And indeed, we are talking about an icon here, and we're talking about someone who has been quite honored as he approaches this centenary birth. Let me get another caller on from Sonoma. Sherry joins us. Sherry, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning. I just want to say, don't let that horse eat that violin. and in walks a smiling magician. Look, he is today's Shakespeare. And those things are going to be remembered for a long time. But he also was a wonderful supporter of the mandolin culture. San Francisco would come out to concerts that I was either in or associated with. And he brought back a book called Guitar Heroes from the Metropolitan and gave it to me. And it became the inspiration for another book that I wrote on Italian mandolin heroes. So I, what can I say? I used him in the classroom. I read Ferlinghetti to my humanities students, and he's just a wonderful person. And gosh, happy birthday, Lorenzo, because he wouldn't let me write in English. I had to write my invitations to him in Italian, so I always call him Lorenzo.
And thank you for calling us this morning, Sherry. Good to hear from you. Appreciate your call. There are lines that just have stayed in my mind all these years, and I suppose there are other listeners who could give credence to that with Lawrence Ferlinghetti's poetry, particularly Coney Island of the Mind. But I'm just thinking about the fact, and Oscar, maybe you can comment on this. Some of those poems were really, for their time, almost heretical. I Am Waiting and Christ Climbed Down from His Bare Tree. These were sort of shaking up the establishment even then.
You know, what good literature wasn't heretical then? I mean, you think about, again, you know, this is sort of, you know, of rebellion against convention, rebellion against staid thinking. Absolutely. This is, you know, the thing about the sort of literature that Lawrence does and the sort of literature that City Lights, the bookstore and the book line promotes, is that it challenges your thinking. It challenges your received notions. That always makes people uncomfortable.
Chloe, you said you were very comfortable talking to him, but you realized probably in some part of your consciousness that you were talking to someone who has had this immense influence and who has really had enormous impact, and probably on you personally too?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I grew up in England, and my dad told me that he grew up himself in London with Lawrence Ferlinghetti's poems. So I sort of had little pieces seeping in from my youth on the other side of the world, basically, you know. So to move here around the year was 2000. And one of the very first places I went was City Lights bookstore. I had several people in England who told me that I was not to return to Heathrow Airport without City Lights book bags and, you know, copies of his poems and this and that. So it was, I remember that first visit that I made into that bookstore very, very clearly. And so, you know, to get to speak with him on the phone in advance of his 100th birthday was a tremendous honor and a tremendous treat. And we had, you know, it was a very bouncy conversation, and we laughed a lot too. I mean, this is one thing I also discussed with Elaine when I went to visit her in the bookstore, is he's got this great sense of humor. You showed me his office, his little corner office behind a door, and some of the things in that office are like, I think, speak to this. Tell them about the lamp.
Well, it's also in his poetry. I wanted to talk about that too, because Oscar's been doing a wonderful job of talking about why he is so beloved as a poet. But and all of these things are part of it. And the sense of humor and the approachability of them, I think, is a big part of what makes it accessible for people. So even if he is ranting about something that he finds outrageous, or if he's talking about something that might be a sacred cow that you don't feel comfortable having it poked, there's usually a joke in there somewhere, mm-hmm. and more than one. And he loves playing with language and making puns on culture, and all these things sneak in. And it's just part of who he is. So you can't really have a conversation with Lawrence and not have that.
And again, it's amazing. I remember writing about Bethlehem and then Pennsylvania, or the smiling mortician scattering semen across the landscape. I mean, there were always those things that just jarred out at you and made you laugh.
When I asked him if he had any advice for a young poet, he just laughed at me and said, "Duck and run for cover."
Let's get another caller aboard here. And that's Robert. You're on with us. Good morning.
Yes. I wanted to ask, I know Lawrence owned the bookstore and the building, and I'm wondering if anyone knows what's going to happen when he passes through the bookstore and the building.
Everyone's looking at me.
I mean, is there a foundation or something that's been, you know, created that's going to continue?
Well, Lawrence does not own the bookstore. City Lights owns the bookstore, which is a hugely important feat that Lawrence and Nancy Peters, who co-owns City Lights with Lawrence, managed to pull off back in 1999 after having rented from the same landlord since 1953. So the fact that City Lights owns its building is a huge part of the capacity for City Lights to continue being in San Francisco. And I want to just assure you that at 100, Lawrence has been old for quite a while now, and there have been many, many, many conversations about what will happen and how the transition to a post-Ferlinghetti future will happen. It's in good hands. I don't want to go into other details like that because that's kind of boring. There is a City Lights Foundation, which is a nonprofit arm of City Lights, and that was conceived as a way to help City Lights into the future. And anybody who wants to know more about that can go to our website and just see what we're up to. But City Lights is safe.
Is Jack Hirschman's wife still doing some cooking for Lawrence? Do you know?
Periodically. Aggie Falk is a poet and a wonderful cook, and Lawrence loves her cooking, and yes.
Well, we have honored him here this morning, and thank you all for joining us to do that. And again, let's remind you that there is a lot of activity going on around the centenary birth of Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Do feel free to participate in it and maybe join us, in fact, Thursday night at City Lights Bookstore. Chloe Voltman, thank you for being with us.
Pleasure. Thanks,
Lane Katzenberger, glad to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And Oscar Villalon, thank you.
Well, good to see you.
And thanks to Jack Hirschman, and thanks to you, our listeners, of course. You can continue this discussion online, kqed.org/forum, and stay tuned for more on this radio station. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.